Side 17, It by Stephen King, continuing on page 620. The TV went off at once, and even before the others could begin to stir, Coots was jerking the door open and saying, "Okay, asshole, get ready to catch your head on the rebound. I've had it."
"No, Ma, no, Ma, please, Ma, no, Ma."
Coots came rushing in. First he saw Bowers, standing tall and paunchy and nearly ridiculous in his Johnny, his loose flesh doughy in the light spilling in from the corridor. Then he looked left and screamed out two lungfuls of silent spun glass. Standing by Bowers was a thing in a clown suit. It stood perhaps 8 feet tall. Its suit was silvery. Orange pom-poms ran down the front. There were oversized funny shoes on its feet, but its head was not that of a man or a clown. It was the head of a Doberman pincher, the only animal on God's green earth of which John Kuntz was frightened. Its eyes were red, its silky muzzle wrinkled back to show huge white teeth. A cylinder of quarters fell from Kuntz's nerveless fingers and rolled across the floor and into the corner. Late the following day, Benny Bolu, who slept through the whole thing, would find them and hide them in his footlocker. The quarters bought him cigarettes, tailor-mades, for a month. Kuntz hitched in his breath to scream again as the clown lurched toward him. "It's time for the circus," the clown screamed in a growling voice, and its white-gloved hands fell on Kuntz's shoulders. Except that the hands inside those gloves felt like paws. 3. For the third time that day, that long, long day, came a call went to the telephone. She got further this time than she had on the first two occasions. This time she waited until the phone had been picked up on the other end, and a hearty Irish cop's voice said, "6th Street Station, Sergeant O'Bannon, how may I help you?" before hanging up. "Oh, you're doing fine. Jesus, yes, by the 8th or 9th time you'll have mustered up guts enough to give him your name." She went into the kitchen and fixed herself a weak scotch and soda, although she knew it probably wasn't a good idea on top of the Darvon. She recalled a snatch of folk song from the college coffee houses of her youth. "Got a head full of whiskey and a belly full of gin. Doctors say it'd kill me, but he don't say when." And laughed jaggedly. There was a mirror running along the top of the bar. She saw her reflection in it and stopped laughing abruptly. "Who is that woman?" One eye swollen nearly shut. "Who is that battered woman?" Knows the color of a drunken night's after 30 or so years of tilting at gin mills and puffed to a grotesque size. "Who is that battered woman who looks like the ones who drag themselves to a women's shelter after they finally get frightened enough or brave enough or just plain mad enough to leave the man who is hurting them, who has systematically hurt them week in and week out, month in and month out, year in and year out?" Laddered scratch up one cheek. "Who is she, K-Bird?" One arm in a sling. "Who? Is it you? Can it be you?" "Here she is, Miss America," she sang, wanting her voice to come out tough and cynical. It started out that way, but warbled on the 7th syllable and cracked on the 8th. It was not a tough voice, it was a scared voice. She knew it. She had been scared before and had always gotten over it. She thought she would be a long time getting over this. The doctor who had treated her in one of the little cubicles just off emergency admitting at Sisters of Mercy, half a mile down the road, had been young and not bad-looking. Under different circumstances, she might have idly, or not so idly, considered trying to get him home and take him on a sexual tour of the world. But she hadn't felt in the least bit horny. Pain wasn't conducive to horniness. Neither was fear. His name was Geffen, and she didn't care for the fixed way he was looking at her. He took a small white paper cup to the room sink, half filled it with water, produced a pack of cigarettes from the drawer of his desk, and offered them to her. She took one, and he lit it for her. He had to chase the tip for a second or two with the match because her hand was shaking. He tossed the match in a paper cup. "This. A wonderful habit," he said, "right?" "Oral fixation," Kay replied. He nodded, and then there was silence. He kept looking at her. She got the feeling he was expecting her to cry, and it made her mad because she felt she might just do that. She hated to be emotionally pre-guessed, and most of all by a man. "Boyfriend?" he asked at last. "I'd rather not talk about it." "Uh-huh." He smoked and looked at her. "Didn't your mother ever tell you it was impolite to stare?" She wanted it to come out hard-edged, but it sounded like a plea. "Stop looking at me. I know how I look. I saw." This thought was followed by another, one she suspected her friend Beverly must have had more than once, that the worst of the beating took place inside. where you were apt to suffer something that might be called interspiritual bleeding. She knew what she looked like, yes. Worse still, she knew what she felt like. She felt yellow. It was a dismal feeling. "I'll say this just once," Geffen said. His voice was low and pleasant. "When I work ER, my turn in the barrel, you might say, I see maybe 24 battered women a week. The interns treat 24 more. So look, there's a telephone right here on the desk. It's my dime. You call 6th Street, give them your name and address, tell them what happened and who did it. Then you hang up and I'll take the bottle of bourbon I keep over there in the file cabinet, strictly for medicinal purposes, you understand, and we'll have a drink on it. Because I happen to think, this is just my personal opinion, that the only lower form of life than a man who would beat up a woman is a rat with syphilis." Kay smiled wanly. "I appreciate the offer," she said, "but I'll pass. For the time being." "Uh-huh," he said. "But when you go home, take a good look at yourself in the mirror, Ms. McCall. Whoever it was, he jobbed you good." She did cry then. She couldn't help it. Tom Rogan had called around noon of the day after she had seen Beverly safely off, wanting to know if Kay had been in touch with his wife. He sounded calm, reasonable, not the least upset. Kay told him she hadn't seen Beverly in almost 2 weeks. Tom thanked her and hung up. Around 1, the doorbell rang while she was writing in her study. She went to the door. "Who is it?"
"Cragen's Flowers, ma'am,"
a high voice said, and how stupid she had been not to realize it had been Tom doing a bad falsetto. How stupid she had been to believe that Tom had given up so easily. How stupid she had been to take the chain off before opening the door. In he had come, and she had gotten just this far. "You get out of here," before Tom's fist came flying out of nowhere, slamming into her right eye, closing it, and sending a bolt of incredible agony through her head. She had gone reeling backward down the hallway, clutching at things to try and stay upright. A delicate one-rose vase that had gone smashing to the tiles, a coat tree that had tumbled over. She fell over her own feet as Tom closed the front door behind him and walked toward her.
"Get out of here,"
she had screamed at him.
"As soon as you tell me where she is," Tom said, walking down the hall toward her.
She was dimly aware that Tom didn't look very good. Well, actually, terrible might have been a better word. And she felt a dim but ferocious gladness skyrocket through her. Whatever Tom had done to Bev, it looked as if Bev had given it back in spades. It had been enough to keep him off his feet for one whole day, anyhow, and he still didn't look as if he belonged anywhere but in a hospital. But he also looked very mean and very angry. Kay scrambled to her feet and backed away, keeping her eyes on him as you might keep your eyes on a wild animal that had escaped its cage.
"I told you I haven't seen her, and that was the truth," she said. "Now get out of here before I call the police."
"You've seen her," Tom said. His swollen lips were trying to grin. She saw that his teeth had a strange, jagged look. Some of the front ones had been broken.
"I call up, tell you I don't know where Bev is. You say you haven't seen her in 2 weeks. Never a single question. Never a discouraging word, even though I know damn well that you hate my guts. So where is she, you numb cunt? Tell me."
Kay turned then and ran for the end of the hall, wanting to get into the parlor, rake the sliding mahogany doors closed on their recessed tracks, and turn the thumb bolt. She got there ahead of him. He was limping, but before she could slam the doors shut, he had inserted his body between. He gave one convulsive lunge and pushed through. She turned to run again. He caught her by her dress and yanked her so hard he tore the entire back of it straight down to her waist.
"Your wife made that dress, you shit,"
she thought incoherently, and then she was twisted around.
"Where is she?"
Kay brought her hand up in a walloping slap that rocked his head back and started the cut on the left side of his face bleeding again. He grabbed her hair and pulled her head forward into his fist. It felt to her for a moment as if her nose had exploded. She screamed, inhaled to scream again, and began to cough on her own blood. She was in utter terror now. She had not known there could be so much terror in all the wide world. The crazy son of a bitch was going to kill her. She screamed, and then his fist looped into her belly, driving the air out of her, and she could only gasp. She began to cough and gasp at the same time, and for one terrifying moment she thought she was going to choke.
"Where is she?"
Kay shook her head.
"Haven't seen her," she gasped. "Police, you'll go to jail, asshole."
He jerked her to her feet, and she felt something give in her shoulder. More pain, so strong it was sickening. He whirled her around, still holding onto her arm, and now he twisted her arm up behind her, and she bit down on her lower lip, promising herself that she would not scream again.
"Where is she?"
K
Kay shook her head. He jerked her arm up again, jerked it so hard that she heard him grunt. His warm breath puffed against her ear. She felt her closed right fist strike her own left shoulder blade, and she screamed again as that thing in her shoulder gave some more. Where is she?
No.
What?
I don't know.
He let go of her and gave her a push. She collapsed to the floor, sobbing, snot and blood running out of her nose. There was an almost musical crash, and when she looked around, Tom was bending over her. He had broken the top off another vase, this one of Waterford crystal. He held the base. The jagged neck was only inches from her face. She stared at it, hypnotized. "Let me tell you something," he said, the words coming out in little pants and blows of warm air. "You're going to tell me where she went, or you're going to be picking your face up off the floor. You've got 3 seconds, maybe less. When I'm mad, it seems like time goes a lot faster." "My face," she thought. And that was what finally caused her to give in. Or cave in, if you liked that better. The thought of this monster using the jagged neck of the Waterford vase to cut her face apart.
"She went home," Kay sobbed. "Her hometown, Derry. It's a place called Derry, in Maine."
"How did she go?"
"She took a bus to Milwaukee. She was going to fly from there."
"That shitty little coos," Tom cried, straightening up. He walked around in a large, aimless semicircle, running his hands through his hair so that it stood up in crazy spikes and whirls. "That cunt, that coos, that nickel-plated crotch." He picked up a delicate wood sculpture of a man and woman making love. She'd had it since she was 22, and threw it into the fireplace where it shattered to splinters. He came face to face with himself for a moment in the mirror over the fireplace and stood wide-eyed, as if looking at a ghost. Then he whirled on her again. He had taken something from the pocket of the sport coat he was wearing, and she saw with a stupid kind of wonder that it was a paperback novel. The cover was almost completely black, except for the red foil letters which spelled out the title and a picture of several young people standing on a high bluff over a river. The Black Rapids. "Who's this fuck?"
"Huh? What?"
"Denbrough, Denbrough." He shook the book impatiently in front of her face, then suddenly slapped her with it. Her cheek flared with pain and then dull red heat like stove coals. "Who is he?" She began to understand.
"They were friends when they were children. They both grew up in Derry."
He whacked her with the book again, this time from the other side.
"Please," she sobbed. "Please, Tom."
He pulled an early American chair with spindly, graceful legs over to her, turned it around, and sat down on it. His jack-o'-lantern face looked down at her over the chair back.
"Listen to me," he said. "You listen to your old Uncle Tommy. Can you do that, you bra-burning bitch?"
She nodded. She could taste blood, hot and coppery, in her throat. Her shoulder was on fire. She prayed it was only dislocated and not broken. But that was not the worst.
"My face. He was going to cut up my face."
"If you call the police and tell them I was here, I'll deny it." "You can't prove a fucking thing. It's the maid's day off, and we're all by our twosome. Of course they might arrest me anyway. Anything's possible, right?" She found herself nodding again, as if her head was on a string. "Sure it is. And what I'd do is post bail and come right back here. They'd find your tits on the kitchen table and your eyes in the fishbowl. Do you understand me? Are you getting your old Uncle Tommy?" Kay burst into tears again. That string attached to her head was still working. It bobbed up and down.
"Why?"
"What? I don't..." "Wake up, for God's sake. Why did she go back?"
"I don't know,"
Kay nearly screamed. He wiggled the broken vase at her.
"I don't know," she said in a lower voice. "Please, she didn't tell me. Please don't hurt me."
He tossed the vase in the wastebasket and stood up. He left without looking back, head down, a big shambling bear of a man. She rushed after him and locked the door. She rushed into the kitchen and locked that door. After a moment's pause, she had limped upstairs, as fast as her aching belly would allow, and had locked the French doors which gave on the upstairs veranda. It was not beyond possibility that he might decide to shinny up one of the pillars and come in again that way. He was hurt, but he was also insane. She went for the telephone for the first time and had no more than dropped her hand on it before remembering what he had said.
"What I'd do is post bail and come right back here. Your tits on the kitchen table and your eyes in the fishbowl."
She jerked her hand off the phone. She went into the bathroom then and looked at her dripping tomato nose, her black eye. She didn't weep. The shame and horror she felt were too deep for tears.
"Oh, Bev, I did the best I could, dear," she thought.
"But my face. He said he would cut up my face."
There was Darvon and Valium in the medicine cabinet. She debated between them and finally swallowed one of each. Then she went to Sisters of Mercy for treatment and met the famous Dr. Geffen, who right now was the only man she could think of whom she would not be perfectly happy to see wiped off the face of the earth. And from there, home again, jiggity jog. She went to her bedroom window and looked out. The sun was low on the horizon now. On the east coast, it would be late twilight, just going on 7 o'clock in Maine. You can decide what to do about the cops later. The important thing now is to warn Beverly. It would be a hell of a lot easier, Kay thought, if you had told me where you were staying, Beverly, my love. I suppose you didn't know yourself. Although she had quit smoking 2 years before, she kept a pack of Pall Mells in the drawer of her desk for emergencies. She shot one out of the pack, lit up, grimaced. She had last smoked from this pack around December of 1982, and this baby was staler than the ERA and the Illinois State Senate. She smoked it anyway, one eye half-lidded against the smoke, the other just half-lidded, period. Thanks to Tom Rogan. Using her left hand laboriously, the son of a bitch had dislocated her good arm, she dialed Maine information and asked for the name and number of every hotel and motel in Derry. "Ma'am, that's going to take a while," the directory assistance operator said dubiously. "It's going to take even longer than that, sister," Kay said. "I'm going to have to write with my stupid hand. My good one's on vacation." "It is not customary for..." "Listen to me," Kay said, not unkindly. "I'm calling you from Chicago, and I'm trying to reach a woman friend of mine who has just left her husband and gone back to Derry, where she grew up. Her husband knows where she went. He got the information out of me by beating the living shit out of me. This man is a psycho. She needs to know he's coming." There was a long pause, and then the directory assistance operator said in a decidedly more human voice, "I think the number you really need is the Derry Police Department." "Fine, I'll take that too. But she has to be warned," Kay said. "And..." She thought of Tom's cut cheeks, the knot on his forehead, the one on his temple, his limp, his hideously swelled lips. "And if she knows he's coming, that may be enough." There was another long pause. "You there, sis?" Kay asked. "Arlington Motor Lodge," the operator said, 643-8146. "Basie Park Inn, 648-4083. The Bunyan Motor Court..." "Slow down a little, okay?" she asked, writing furiously. She looked for an ashtray, didn't see one, and mashed the pell-mell out on the desk blotter. "Okay, go on." "The Clarendon Inn, 4. She got half lucky on her fifth call. Beverly Rogan was registered at the Derry townhouse. She was only half lucky because Beverly was out. She left her name and number and a message that Beverly should call her the instant she came back, no matter how late it was. The desk clerk repeated the message. Kay went upstairs and took another Valium. She lay down and waited for sleep. Sleep didn't come. "I'm sorry, Bev," she thought, looking into the dark, floating on the dope. "What he said about my face. I just couldn't stand that. Call soon, Bev. Please call soon. And watch out for the crazy son of a bitch you married." 5. The crazy son of a bitch Bev had married did better on connections than Beverly had the day before because he left from O'Hare, the hub of commercial aviation in the continental United States. During the flight, he read and reread the brief note on the author at the end of the Black Rapids. It said that William Denbrough was a native of New England and the author of 3 other novels, which were also available, the note added helpfully, in signet paperback editions. He and his wife, the actress Audra Phillips, lived in California. He was currently at work on a new novel. Noticing that the paperback of The Black Rapids had been issued in 1976, Tom supposed the guy had written some of the other novels since then. Audra Phillips. He had seen her in the movies, hadn't he? He rarely noticed actresses. Tom's idea of a good flick was a crime story, a chase story, or a monster picture. But if this babe was the one he was thinking of, he had noticed her especially because she looked a lot like Beverly. Long red hair, green eyes, tits that wouldn't quit. He sat up a little straighter in his seat, tapping the paperback against his leg, trying to ignore the ache in his head and in his mouth. Yes, he was sure. Audra Phillips was the redhead with the good tits. He had seen her in a Clint Eastwood movie, and then about a year later in a horror flick called Graveyard Moon. Beverly had gone with him to see that one, and coming out of the theater, he had mentioned his idea that the actress looked a lot like her. "I don't think so," Bev had said. "I'm taller and she's prettier. Her hair's a darker red, too." That was all. He hadn't thought of it again until now. He and his wife, the actress Audra Phillips. Tom had some dim understanding of psychology. He had used it to manipulate his wife all the years of their marriage. And now a nagging unpleasantness began to nag at him. More feeling than thought. It centered on the fact that Bev and this Denbro had played together as kids, and that Denbro had married a woman who, in spite of what Beverly said, looked amazingly like Tom Rogan's wife. What sort of games had Denbro and Beverly played when they were kids? Post office? Spin the bottle? Other games? Tom sat in his seat and tapped the book against his leg and felt his temples begin to throb. When he arrived at Bangor International Airport and canvassed the rental car booths, the girls, some dressed in yellow, some in red, some in Irish green, looked at his blasted, dangerous face nervously and told him, more nervously still, that they had no cars to rent, so sorry. Tom went to the newsstand and got a Bangor paper. He turned to the want ads, oblivious to the looks he was getting from people passing by, and isolated three likelies. He hit pay dirt on his second call. Paper says you've got a 76 LTD wagon, $1,400. Right, sure. I tell you what, Tom said, touching the wallet in his jacket pocket. It was fat with cash, $6,000. You bring it out to the airport, and we'll do the deal right here. You give me the car and bill of sale and your pink slip, I'll give you cash money. The fellow with the LTD for sale paused and then said, I'd have to take my plates off. Sure, fine. How will I know you, Mr. Barr, Tom said. He was looking at a sign across the terminal lobby that said, Bar Harbor Airlines gives you New England and the world. I'll be standing by the far door. You'll know me because my face doesn't look so hot. My wife and I went roller skating yesterday and I took one hell of a fall. Things could be worse, I guess. I didn't break anything but my face. See, I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Barr. I'll mend. You just get the car out here, my good buddy. He hung up, walked across to the door, and stepped out into the warm, fragrant May night. The guy with the LTD showed up 10 minutes later, driving out of the late spring dusk. He was only a kid. They did the deal. The kid scribbled him a bill of sale, which Tom stuffed indifferently into his overcoat pocket. He stood there and watched the kid take off the LTD's main plates. Give you an extra $3 for the screwdriver, Tom said when he was done. The kid looked at him thoughtfully for a moment, shrugged, handed the screwdriver over, and took the three ones Tom was holding out. None of my business, the shrug said, and Tom thought, how right you are, my good little buddy. Tom saw him into a cab, then got behind the wheel of the Ford. It was a piece of shit. Transmission whiny, universal groany, body rattly, brakes slushy. None of it mattered. He drove around to the long-term parking lot, took a ticket, and drove in. He parked next to a Subaru that looked as if it had been there for a while. He used the kid's screwdriver to remove the Subaru's plates and put them on the LTD. He hummed as he worked. By 10 p.m. he was driving east on Route 2, a main road map open on the seat beside him. He had discovered that the LTD's radio didn't work, so he drove in silence. That was all right. He had plenty to think about. All the wonderful things he was going to do to Beverly when he caught up with her, for instance. He was sure in his heart, quite sure, that Beverly was close by. And smoking. Oh, my dear girl, you fucked with the wrong man when you fucked with Tom Rogan. And the question is this, what exactly are we to do with you? The Ford bowled its way through the night, chasing its high beams, and by the time Tom got to Newport, he knew. He found a drugs and sundries shop on the main drag that was still open. He went inside and bought a carton of Camels. The proprietor wished him a good evening. Tom wished him the same. He tossed the carton on the seat and got moving again. He drove slowly on up Route 7, hunting for his turnoff. Here it was, Route 3, with a sign which read Haven 21, Dairy 15. He made the turn and got the Ford rolling faster. He glanced at the carton of cigarettes and smiled a little. In the green glow of the dash lights, his cut and lumpy face looked strange, ghoulish. Got some cigarettes for you, Bevy, Tom thought as the wagon ran between stands of pine and spruce, heading toward Derry at a little better than 60. Oh, my, yes, a whole carton just for you. And when I see you, dear, I'm going to make you eat every fucking one. And if this guy Denbro needs some education, we can arrange that, too. No problem, Bevy, no problem at all. For the first time since the dirty bitch had bushwhacked him and run out, Tom began to feel good. 6. Audra Denbrough flew first class to Maine on a British Airways DC-10. She had left Heathrow at 6:10 that afternoon and had been chasing the sun ever since. The sun was winning, had won in fact, but that didn't really matter. By a stroke of providential luck, she had discovered that British Airways Flight 23, London to Los Angeles, made one refueling stop at Bangor International Airport. The day had been a crazy nightmare. Freddie Firestone, the producer of Attic Room, had of course wanted Bill first thing. There had been some kind of balls up about the stunt woman who was supposed to fall down a flight of stairs for Audra. It seemed that stunt people had a union too, and this woman had fulfilled her quota of stunts for the week, or some silly thing. The union was demanding that Freddie either sign an extension of salary waiver or hire another woman to do the stunt. The problem was there was no other woman close enough to Audra's body type available. Freddie told the union boss that they would have to get a man to do the stunt then, wouldn't they? It wasn't as if the fall had to be taken in bra and panties. They had the auburn-haired wig, and the wardrobe woman could fit the fellow up with falsies and hip padding. Even some arse pads, if that was necessary. "Can't be done, mate," the union boss said. "Against the union charter to have a man step in for a woman. Sexual discrimination." In the movie business, Freddie's temper was fabled, and at that point he had lost it. He told the union boss, a fat man whose B.O. was almost paralyzing, to bugger himself. The union boss told Freddie he better watch his gob or there would be no more stunts on the set of Attic Room at all. Then he had rubbed his thumb and forefinger together in a bakshish gesture that had driven Freddie crazy. The union boss was big but soft. Freddie, who still played football every chance he got, and who had once bowled a century at cricket, was big and hard. He threw the union boss out, went back into his office to meditate, and then came out again 20 minutes later hollering for Bill. He wanted the entire scene rewritten so that the fall could be scrubbed. Audra had to tell Freddie that Bill was no longer in England. "What?" Freddie said. His mouth hung open. He was looking at Audra as if he believed she had gone mad. "What are you telling me?" "He's been called back to the States. That's what I'm telling you." Freddie made as if to grab her, and Audra shrank back, a bit afraid. Freddie looked down at his hands, then put them in his pockets and only looked at her. "I'm sorry, Freddie," she said in a small voice. "Really." She got up and poured herself a cup of coffee from the Silex on Freddie's hot plate, noticing that her hands were trembling slightly. As she sat down, she heard Freddie's amplified voice over the studio loudspeakers, telling everyone to go home or to the pub. The day's shooting was off. Audra winced. There went a minimum of £10,000 right down the bog. Freddie turned off the studio intercom, got up, poured his own cup of coffee. He sat down again and offered her his pack of silk-cut cigarettes. Audra shook her head. Freddie took one, lit it, and squinted at her through the smoke. "This is serious, isn't it?" "Yes," Audra said, keeping her composure as best she could. "What's happened?" And because she genuinely liked Freddie and genuinely trusted him, Audra told him everything she knew. Freddie listened intently, gravely. It didn't take long to tell. Doors were still slamming and engines starting in the parking lot outside when she finished. Freddie was silent for some time, looking out his window. Then he swung back to her. "He's had a nervous breakdown of some sort." Audra shook her head. "No, it wasn't like that. He wasn't like that." She swallowed and added, "Maybe you had to be there." Freddie smiled crookedly. "You must realize that grown men rarely feel compelled to honor promises they made as little boys. And you've read Bill's work. You know how much of it is about childhood, and it's very good stuff indeed. Very much on the nail. The idea that he's forgotten everything that ever happened to him back then is absurd." "The scars on his hands," Audra said. "They were never there, not until this morning." "Bollocks. You just didn't notice them until this morning." She shrugged helplessly. "I'd have noticed." She could see he didn't believe that either. "What's to do then?" Freddie asked her, and she could only shake her head. Freddie lit another cigarette from the smoldering end of the first. "I can square it with the union boss," he said. "Not myself, maybe. Right now, he'd see me in hell before giving me another stunt. I'll send Teddy Rowland round to his office. Teddy's a poof, but he could talk the birds down from the trees. But what happens after? We've got 4 weeks of shooting left, and here's your husband somewhere in Massachusetts." "Maine." He waved a hand. "Wherever.
And how much good are you going to be without him? He leaned forward. I like you, Audra. I genuinely do. And I like Bill, even in spite of this mess. We can make do, I guess. If the script needs cobbling up, I can cobble it. I've done my share of that sort of shoemaking in my time, Christ knows. If he doesn't like the way it turns out, he'll have no one but himself to blame. I can do without Bill, but I can't do without you. I can't have you running off to the States after your man, and I've got to have you putting out at full power. Can you do that?
I don't know.
Nor do I, but I want you to think about something. We can keep things quiet for a while, maybe for the rest of the shoot, if you'll stand up like a trooper and do your job. But if you take off, it can't be kept quiet. I can be pissy, but I'm not vindictive by nature, and I'm not going to tell you that if you take off, I'll see that you never work in the business again. But you should know that if you get a reputation for temperament, you might end up stuck with just that. I'm talking to you like a Dutch uncle, I know. Do you resent it?
No, she said listlessly.
In truth, she didn't care much one way or the other. Bill was all she could think of. Freddie was a nice enough man, but Freddie didn't understand. In the last analysis, nice man or not, all he could think of was what this was going to do to his picture. He had not seen the look in Bill's eyes, or heard him stutter. Good, he stood up. Come on over to the Hare and Hounds with me. We can both use a drink. She shook her head. A drink's the last thing I need. I'm going home and think this out. I'll call for the car, he said. No, I'll take the train. He looked at her fixedly, one hand on the telephone. I believe you mean to go after him, Freddie said, and I'm telling you that it's a serious mistake, dear girl. He's got a bee in his bonnet. But at bottom, he's steady enough. He'll shake it, and when he does, he'll come back. If he'd wanted you along, he would have said so.
I haven't decided anything, she said,
knowing that she had, in fact, decided everything, had decided even before the car picked her up that morning. Have a care, love, Freddie said. Don't do something you'll regret later. She felt the force of his personality beating on her, demanding that she give in, make the promise, do her job, wait passively for Bill to come back, or to disappear again into that hole of the past from which he had come. She went to him and kissed him lightly on the cheek.
I'll see you, Freddie.
She went home and called British Airways. She told the clerk she might be interested in reaching a small main city called Derry if it was at all possible. There had been silence while the woman consulted her computer terminal, and then the news, like a sign from heaven, that BA number 23 made a stop in Bangor, which was less than 50 miles away. Shall I book the flight for you, ma'am? Audra closed her eyes and saw Freddie's craggy, mostly kind, very earnest face, heard him saying, Have a care, love. Don't do something you'll regret later. Freddie didn't want her to go. Bill didn't want her to go. So why was her heart screaming at her that she had to go? She closed her eyes.
Jesus, I feel so fucked up.
Ma'am, are you still holding the wire?
Book it, Audra said, then hesitated.
Have a care, love.
Maybe she should sleep on it, get some distance between herself and the craziness.
She began to rummage in her purse for her American Express card.
For tomorrow, first class if you have it, but I'll take anything.
And if I change my mind, I can cancel. Probably will. I'll wake up sane and everything will be clear. But nothing had been clear this morning, and her heart clamored just as loudly for her to go. Her sleep had been a crazy tapestry of nightmares. So she had called Freddie, not because she wanted to, but because she felt she owed him that. She had not gotten far. She was trying, in some stumbling way, to tell him how much she felt Bill might need her, when there was a soft click at Freddie's end. He had hung up without saying a word after his initial hello. But in a way, Audra thought, that soft click said everything that needed to be said. 7. The plane landed at Bangor at 7:09 Eastern Daylight Time. Audra was the only passenger to the plane, and the others looked at her with a kind of thoughtful curiosity, probably wondering why anyone would choose to get off here in this godforsaken little place. Audra thought of telling them, I'm looking for my husband, that's why. He came back to a little town near here because one of his boyhood chums called him and reminded him of a promise he couldn't quite remember. The call also reminded him that he hadn't thought of his dead brother in over 20 years. Oh, yes, it also brought back his stutter and some funny white scars on the palms of his hands. And then she thought,
The customs agent standing by in the jetway would whistle up the men in the white coats. She collected her single piece of luggage, it looked very lonely riding the carousel all by itself, and approached the rental car booths as Tom Rogan would about an hour later. Her luck was better than his would be. National Car Rental had a Datsun. The girl filled out the form and Audra signed it. "I thought it was you," the girl said, and then timidly, "Might I please have your autograph?" Audra gave it, writing her name on the back of a rental form, and thought, "Enjoy it while you can, girl. If Freddie Firestone is right, it won't be worth doodly squat 5 years from now." With some amusement, she realized that, after only 15 minutes back in the States, she had begun to think like an American again. She got a road map, and the girl, so starstruck she could barely talk, managed to trace out her best route to Derry. 10 minutes later, Audra was on the road, reminding herself at every intersection that if she forgot and began driving on the left, they would be scrubbing her off the asphalt. And as she drove, she realized that she was more frightened than she had ever been in her life. 8. By one of those odd quirks of fate or coincidence which sometimes obtain, and which in truth obtained more frequently in Derry, Tom had taken a room at the Koala Inn on Outer Jackson Street, and Audra had taken a room at the Holiday Inn. The two motels were side by side, their parking lots divided only by a raised concrete sidewalk. And as it so happened, Audra's rented Datsun and Tom's purchased LTD wagon were parked nose to nose, separated only by that walkway. Both slept now, Audra quietly on her side, Tom Rogan on his back, snoring so heavily that his swollen lips flapped. 9. Henry spent that day hiding in the Puckies beside Route 9. Sometimes he slept, sometimes he lay watching police cruisers slide by like hunting dogs. While the losers ate lunch, Henry listened to voices from the moon. And when dark fell, he went out to the verge of the road and stuck out his thumb. After a while, some fool came along and picked him up. Derry, the third interlude. A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. Emily Dickinson, a bird came down the walk. March 17, 1985. The fire at the Black Spot happened in the late fall of 1930. So far as I am able to determine, that fire, the one my father barely escaped, ended the cycle of murder and disappearance which happened in the years 1929-30. Just as the explosion at the ironworks ended a cycle some 25 years before. It is as if a monstrous sacrifice is needed at the end of the cycle to quiet whatever terrible force it is which works here, to send it to sleep for another quarter century or so. But if such a sacrifice is needed to end each cycle, it seems that some similar event is needed to set each cycle in motion, which brings me to the Bradley Gang. Their execution took place at the three-way intersection of Canal, Maine, and Kansas. Not far, in fact, from the place shown in the picture which began to move for Bill and Richie one day in June of 1958. Some 13 months before the fire at the Black Spot in October of 1929, not long before the stock market crash. As with the fire at the Black Spot, many Derry residents affect not to remember what happened that day. Or they were out of town visiting relatives. Or they were napping that afternoon and never found out what had happened until they heard it on the radio news that night. Or they will simply look you full in the face and lie to you. The police logs for that day indicate that Chief Sullivan was not even in town. "Sure, I remember," Aloysius Nell told me from a chair on the sun terrace of the Paulson Nursing Home in Bangor. "That was my first year on the force, and I ought to remember. He was off in western Maine bird hunting. They'd been cheated and carried off by the time he got back. Madder than a wet hen was Jim Sullivan." But a picture in a reference book on gangsters called Blood Letters and Bad Men shows a grinning man standing beside the bullet-riddled corpse of Al Bradley in the morgue. And if that man is not Chief Sullivan, it is surely his twin brother. It was from Mr. Keene that I finally got what I believed to be the true version of the story. Norbert Keene, who was the proprietor of the Center Street drugstore from 1925 until 1975. He talked to me willingly enough, but, like Betty Ripsom's father, he made me turn off my tape recorder before he would really unwind the tale. Not that it mattered. I can hear his papery voice yet,
another a cappella singer in the damned choir that is this town.
No reason not to tell you, he said. No one will print it, and no one would believe it even if they did.
He offered me an old-fashioned apothecary jar.
Licorice whip? As I remember, you were always partial to the red ones, Mikey.
I took one. Was Chief Sullivan there that day? Mr. Keene laughed and took a licorice whip for himself.
You wondered about that, did you?
I wondered, I agreed, chewing a piece of the red licorice. I hadn't had one since I was a kid, shoving my pennies across the counter to a much younger and spryer Mr. Keene. It tasted just as fine as it had back then.
You're too young to remember when Bobby Thompson hit his home run for the Giants in the playoff game in 1951,
Mr. Keene said.
You would have been but 4 years old. Well, they ran an article about that game in the newspaper a few years after, and it seemed like just about a million folks from New York claimed they were there in the ballpark that day.
Mr. Keene gummed his licorice whip, and a little dark drool ran down from the corner of his mouth. He wiped it off fastidiously with his handkerchief. We were sitting in the office behind the drugstore, because although Norbert Keene was 85 and retired 10 years, he still did the books for his grandson.
Just the opposite when it comes to the Bradley gang, Keene exclaimed.
He was smiling, but it was not a pleasant smile. It was cynical, coldly reminiscent.
There was maybe 20,000 people who lived in downtown Derry back then. Main Street and Canal Street had both been paved for 4 years, but Kansas Street was still dirt. Raised dust in the summer and turned into a bog hole every March and November. They used to oil up Mile Hill every June, and every 4th of July the mayor would talk about how they were going to pave Kansas Street, but it never happened until 1942. But what was I saying?
20,000 people who lived right downtown, I prompted.
Oh, yeah? Well, of those 20,000, there's probably half that have passed away since, maybe even more. 50 years is a long time, and people have a funny way of dying young in Derry. Perhaps it is the air. But of those left, I don't think you'd find more than a dozen who'd say they were in town the day the Bradley gang went to Tophet. Butch Rowden over at the meat market would fess up to it, I guess. He keeps a picture of one of the cars they had up on the wall where he cuts meat. Looking at that picture, you'd hardly know it was a car. Charlotte Littlefield would tell you a thing or two, if you could get on her good side. She teaches over to the high school, and although I reckon she must not have been more than 10 or 12 at the time, I bet she remembers plenty. Carl Snow, Aubrey Stacy, Eben Stampnell, and that old geezer who paints those funny pictures and drinks all night at Wally's. Pickman, I think his name is. They'd remember. They were all there.
He trailed off vaguely, looking at the licorice whip in his hand. I thought of prodding him and decided not to. At last he said,
"Most of the others would lie about it, the way people lied and said they were there when Bobby Thompson hit his homer. That's all I mean. But people lied about being at that ball game because they wished they had been there. People would lie to you about being in Derry that day because they wished they hadn't been. Do you understand me, Sonny?"
I nodded.
"You sure you want to hear the rest of this?"
Mr. Keene asked me.
"You're looking a bit peaked, Mr. Mikey."
"I don't," I said, "but I think I'd better all the same."
"Okay,"
Mr. Keene said mildly. It was my day for memories. As he offered me the apothecary jar with the licorice whips in it, I suddenly remembered a radio program my mother and dad used to listen to when I was just a little kid. "Mr. Keene, Tracer of Lost Persons."
"Sheriff was there that day, all right. He was supposed to go bird hunting, but he changed his mind damn quick when Lal Machen came in and told him that he was expecting Al Bradley that very afternoon."
"How did Machen know that?" I asked.
"Well, that's an instructive tale in itself,"
Mr. Keene said, and the cynical smile creased his face again.
"Bradley wasn't never public enemy number one on the FBI's hit parade, but they had wanted him since 1928 or so, to show they could cut the mustard, I guess. Al Bradley and his brother George hit 6 or 7 banks across the Midwest and then kidnapped a banker for ransom. The ransom was paid, $30,000, a big sum for those days, but they killed the banker anyway. By then the Midwest had gotten a little toasty for the gangs that ran there, so Al and George and their litter of ratlings run northeast, up this way. They rented themselves a big farmhouse just over the town line in Newport, not far from where the Rulin Farms are today. That was in the dog days of 29. Maybe July, maybe August, maybe even early September. I don't know for sure just when. There were 8 of them. Al Bradley, George Bradley, Joe Conklin, and his brother Cal, an Irishman named Arthur Malloy, who was called Creeping Jesus Malloy, because he was nearsighted but wouldn't put on his specs unless he absolutely had to, and Patrick Cawdy, a young fellow from Chicago who was said to be killed crazy but as handsome as Adonis. There were also 2 women with them, Kitty Donahue, George Bradley's common-law wife, and Marie Hauser, who belonged to Cawdy but sometimes got passed around, according to the stories we all heard later. They made one bad assumption when they got up here, Sonny. They got the idea they were so far away from Indiana that they were safe. They lay low for a while, and then got bored and decided they wanted to go hunting. They had plenty of firepower, but they were a bit low on ammunition. So they all came into Derry on the 7th of October in 2 cars. Patrick Cawdy took the women around shopping, while the other men went into Machen's Sporting Goods. Kitty Donahue bought a dress in Freese's, and she died in it 2 days later. Lal Machen waited on the men himself. He died in 1959. Too fat he was, always too fat. But there wasn't nothing wrong with his eyes. And he knew it was Al Bradley the minute he walked in, he said. He thought he recognized some of the others, but he wasn't sure of Malloy until he put on his specs to look at a display of knives in a glass case. Al Bradley walked up to him and said, "We'd like to buy some ammunition." "Well," Lal Machen says, "you come to the right place." Bradley handed him a paper, and Lal read it over. The paper has been lost, at least so far as I know, but Lal said it would have turned your blood cold. They wanted 500 rounds of .38 caliber ammunition, 800 rounds of .45 caliber, 60 rounds of .50 caliber, which they don't even make anymore, shotgun shells loaded both with buck and bird, and 1,000 rounds each of .22 short and long rifle. Plus, get this, 16,000 rounds of .45 machine gun bullets. "Holy shit," I said. Mr. Keene smiled that cynical smile again and offered me the apothecary jar. At first I shook my head, and then I took another whip. "This here is quite a shopping list, boys," Lal says. "Come on, Al," Creeping Jesus Malloy says. "I told you we wasn't going to get it in a hick town like this. Let's go on up to Bangor. They won't have nothing there either, but I can use a ride." "Now hold your horses," Lal says, just as cool as a cucumber. "This here is one hell of a good order, and I wouldn't want to lose it to that Jew up Bangor. I can give you the .22s right now, also the bird and half the buck. I can give you 100 rounds each of the .38 and .45 caliber, too. I could have the rest for you." And here Lal sort of half-closed his eyes and tapped his chin, as if calculating it out. "By day after tomorrow. How'd that be?" Bradley grinned like he'd split his head around the back and said it sounded just as fine as paint. Cal Conklin said he'd still like to go up to Bangor, but he was outvoted. "Now, if you're not sure you can make good on this order, you ought to say so right now," Al Bradley says to Lal. "Because I'm a pretty fine fellow, but when I get mad, you don't want to get into a pissing contest with me. You follow?" "I do," Lal says, "and I'll have all the ammo you could want. Mr. Raider," Brady says, "Richard D. Raider, at your service." He stuck out his hand, and Lal pumped it, grinning all the while. "Real pleased, Mr. Raider." So then Bradley asked him what would be a good time for him and his friends to drop by and pick up the goods, and Lal Machen asked them right back how 2 in the afternoon sounded to them. They agreed that would be fine. Out they went. Lal watched them go. They met the 2 women and Cawdy on the sidewalk outside. Lal recognized Cawdy, too. "So," Mr. Keene said, looking at me bright-eyed, "what do you think Lal done then? Called the cops?" "I guess he didn't," I said, "based on what happened. Me, I would have broken my leg getting to the telephone." "Well, maybe you would, and maybe you wouldn't," Mr. Keene said with that same cynical, bright-eyed smile, and I shivered because I knew what he meant, and he knew I knew. Once something heavy begins to roll, it can't be stopped. It's simply going to roll until it finds a flat place long enough to wear away all of its forward motion. You can stand in front of that thing and get flattened, but that won't stop it either. "Maybe you would have, and maybe you wouldn't," Mr. Keene repeated. "But I can tell you what Lal Machen did. The rest of that day and all of the next, when someone he knew came in, some man, Why, he would tell them that he knew who had been out in the woods around the Newport Dairy line shooting at deer and grouse and God knows what else with Kansas City typewriters. It was the Bradley gang. He knew for a fact because he had recognized them. He'd tell them that Bradley and his men were coming back the next day around 2 to pick up the rest of their order. He'd tell them he'd promised Bradley all the ammunition he could want, and that was a promise he intended to keep.
How many? I asked. I felt hypnotized by his glittering eye. Suddenly the dry smell of this back room, the smell of prescription drugs and powders, of muster roll and Vicks Vapor Rub and Robitussin cough syrup, suddenly all those smells seemed suffocating. But I could no more have left than I could kill myself by holding my breath.
How many men did Lyle pass the word to?
Mr. Keene asked. I nodded.
Don't know for sure, Mr. Keene said. Didn't stand right there and take up sentry duty. All those he felt he could trust, I suppose.
Those he could trust, I mused. My voice was a little hoarse.
Aye, Mr. Keene said. Dairymen, you know. Not that many of them raised cows.
He laughed at this old joke before going on.
I came in around 10 the day after the Bradleys first dropped in on Lal. He told me the story, then asked how he could help me. I'd only come in to see if my last roll of pictures had been developed. In those days, Machens handled all the Kodak films and cameras. But after I got my photos, I also said I could use some ammo for my Winchester. You gonna shoot some game, Norb? Lal asks me, passing over the shells. Might plug some varmints, I said, and we had us a chuckle over that.
Mr. Keene laughed and slapped his skinny leg as if this was still the best joke he had ever heard. He leaned forward and tapped my knee.
All I mean, son, is that the story got around all it needed to. Small towns, you know. If you tell the right people, what you need to pass along will get along. See what I mean? Like another licorice whip?
I took one with numb fingers.
Make you fat, Mr. Keene said and cackled.
He looked old then, infinitely old, with his bifocals slipping down the gaunt blade of his nose and the skin stretched too tight and thin across his cheeks to wrinkle.
The next day I brought my rifle into the store with me, and Bob Tanner, who worked harder than any assistant I ever had after him, brought in his pop shotgun. Around 11 that day, Gregory Cole came in for a bicarb of soda, and damned if he didn't have a Colt 45 jammed right in his belt. Don't blow your balls off with that, Greg, I said. I come out of the woods all the way from Milford for this, and I got one fuck of a hangover, Greg says. I guess I'll blow someone's balls off before the sun goes down. Around 1:30, I put the little sign I had, be back soon, please be patient, in the door, and took my rifle and walked out the back into Richard's Alley. I asked Bob Tanner if he wanted to come along, and he said he'd better finish filling Mrs. Emerson's prescription and he'd see me later. Leave me a live one, Mr. Keene, he said, but I allowed as how I couldn't promise nothing. There was hardly any traffic on Canal Street at all, either on foot or by car. Every now and then a delivery truck would pass, but that was about all. I saw Jake Pinnett cross over, and he had a rifle in each hand. He met Andy Chris, and they walked over to one of the benches that used to stand where the war memorial was, you know, where the canal goes underground. Petey Van Ness and Al Nell and Jimmy Gordon were all sitting on the courthouse steps, eating sandwiches and fruit out of their dinner buckets, trading with each other for stuff that looked better to them, the way kids do on the schoolyard. They was all armed. Jimmy Gordon had himself a World War I Springfield that looked bigger than he did. I see a kid walking toward Up Mile Hill. I think maybe it was Zach Denbro, the father of your old buddy, the one who turned out to be a writer. And Kenny Borton says from the window of the Christian Science reading room, "You want to get out of here, kid. There's going to be shooting." Zach took one look at his face and ran like hell. There were men everywhere, men with guns, standing in doorways and sitting on steps and looking out of windows. Greg Cole was sitting in a doorway down the street with his 45 in his lap and about 2 dozen shells lined up beside him like toy soldiers. Bruce Jaegermeier and that Swede Olaf Theramenius were standing underneath the marquee of the Bijou in the shade.
Mr. Keene looked at me, through me. His eyes were not sharp now. They were hazy with memory, soft as the eyes of a man only become when he is remembering one of the best times of his life. The first home run he ever hit, maybe. Or the first trout he ever landed that was big enough to keep. Or the first time he ever lay with a willing woman.
I remember I heard the wind, sonny, he said dreamily. I remember hearing the wind and hearing the courthouse clock toll two. Bob Tanner came up behind me, and I was so tight-wired I almost blew his head off. He only nodded at me and crossed over to Vanek's Dry Goods, trailing his shadow out behind him. You would have thought that when it got to be 2:10 and nothing happened, then 2:15, then 2:20, folks would have just up and left, wouldn't you? But it didn't happen that way at all. People just kept their place. Because
you knew they were going to come, didn't you? I asked. There was never any question at all. He beamed at me like a teacher pleased with a student's recital.
That's right, he said. We knew. No one had to talk about it. No one had to say, well, now, let's wait until 20 past, and if they don't show, I've got to get back to work. Things just stayed quiet. And around 2:25 that afternoon, these two cars, one red and one dark blue, started down Up Mile Hill and came into the intersection. One of them was a Chevrolet, and the other was a LaSalle. The Conklin brothers, Patrick Cotty and Marie Hauser, were in the Chevrolet. The Bradleys, Malloy, and Kitty Donahue were in the LaSalle. They started through the intersection okay, and then Al Bradley slammed on the brakes of that LaSalle so sudden that Cotty damn near ran into him. The street was too quiet, and Bradley knew it. He wasn't nothing but an animal, but it doesn't take much to put up an animal's wind when it's been chased like a weasel in the corn for 4 years. He opened the door of the LaSalle and stood up on the running board for a moment. He looked around, then he made a go-back gesture to Cotty with his hand. Cotty said, "What, boss?" I heard that plain as day, the only thing I heard any of them say that day. There was a wink of sun, too. I remember that. It came off a compact mirror. The Hauser woman was powdering her nose. That was when Lal Machen and his helper, Biff Marlowe, came running out of Machen's store. "Put him up, Bradley. You're surrounded," Lal shouts, and before Bradley could do more than turn his head, Lal started blasting. He was wild at first, but then he put one into Bradley's shoulder. The claret started to pour out of that hole right away. Bradley caught hold of the LaSalle's doorpost and swung himself back into the car. He threw it into gear, and that's when everyone started to shoot. It was all over in 4, maybe 5 minutes. But it seemed a whole hell of a lot longer while it was happening. Petey and Al and Jimmy Gordon just sat there on the courthouse steps and poured bullets into the back end of the Chevrolet. I saw Bob Tanner down on one knee, firing and working the bolt on that old rifle of his like a madman. Jaegermeier and Theramenius were shooting into the right side of the LaSalle from under the theater marquee, and Greg Cole stood in the gutter, holding that .45 automatic out in both hands, pulling the trigger just as fast as he could work it. There must have been 50, 60 men firing all at once. After it was all over, Lal Machen dug 36 slugs out of the brick sides of his store. And that was 3 days later, after just about every damn buddy in town who wanted one for a souvenir had come down and dug one out with his penknife. When it was at its worst, it sounded like the Battle of the Marne. Windows were blown in by rifle fire all around Machen's. Bradley got the LaSalle around in a half circle, and he wasn't slow, but by the time he'd done, he was running on 4 flats. Both the headlights were blowed out, and the windscreen was gone. Creeping Jesus Malloy and George Bradley were each at a backseat window firing pistols. I seen one bullet take Malloy high up in the neck and tear it wide open. He shot twice more and then collapsed out the window with his arms hanging down. Cotty tried to turn the Chevrolet and only ran into the back end of Bradley's LaSalle. That was really the end of 'em right there, son. The Chevrolet's front bumper locked with the LaSalle's back one, and there went any chance they might have had to make a run for it. Joe Conklin got out of the back seat and just stood there in the middle of the intersection, a pistol in each hand, and started to pour it on. He was shooting at Jake Panette and Andy Chris. The two of them fell off the bench they'd been sitting on and landed in the grass, Andy Chris shouting, I'm killed," over and over again. Although he was never so much as touched. Neither of them were. Joe Conklin, he had time to fire both his guns empty before anything so much as touched him. His coat flew back and his pants twitched like some woman you couldn't see was stitching on them. He was wearing a straw hat and it flew off his head so you could see how he'd center-parted his hair. He had one of his guns under his arm and was trying to reload the other when someone cut the legs out from under him and he went down. Kenny Borton claimed him later, but there was really no way to tell. Could have been anybody. Conklin's brother Cal came out after him soon as Joe fell, and down he went like a ton of bricks with a hole in his head. Marie Hauser came out. Maybe she was trying to surrender, I don't know. She still had the compact she'd been using to powder her nose in her right hand. She was screaming, I believe, but by then it was hard to hear. Bullets was flying all around them. That compact mirror was blown right out of her hand. She started back to the car then, but she took one in the hip. She made it somehow and managed to crawl inside again. Al Bradley revved the LaSalle up just as high as it would go and managed to get it moving again. He dragged the Chevrolet maybe 10 feet before the bumper tore right off in it. The boys poured lead into it. All the windows was busted. One of the mud guards was laying in the street. Malloy was dead, hanging out the window, but both of the Bradley brothers were still alive. George was firing from the back seat. His woman was dead beside him with one of her eyes shot out. Al Bradley got to the big intersection, then his auto mounted the curb and stopped there. He got out from behind the wheel and started running up Canal Street. He was riddled. Patrick Caudy got out of the Chevrolet, looked as if he was going to surrender for a minute. Then he grabbed a .38 from a cheater holster under his armpit. He triggered it off maybe 3 times, just firing wild, and then his shirt blew back from his chest in flames. He slid down the side of the Chevy until he was sitting on the running board. He shot one more time, and so far as I know, that was the only bullet that hit anyone. It ricocheted off something and then grazed across the back of Greg Cole's hand. Left a scar he used to show off when he was drunk until someone, Al Nell maybe, took him aside and told him it might be a good idea to shut up about what happened to the Bradley gang. The Hauser woman came out, and that time wasn't any doubt she was trying to surrender. She had her hands up. Maybe no one really meant to kill her, but by then there was a crossfire and she walked right into it. George Bradley run up as far as that bench by the war memorial, then someone pulped the back of his head with a shotgun blast. He fell down dead with his pants full of piss.
Hardly aware I was doing it, I took a licorice whip from the jar.
They went on pouring rounds into those cars for another minute or so before it began to taper off, Mr. Keene said. When men get their blood up, it doesn't go down easy. That was when I looked around and saw Sheriff Sullivan behind Nell and the others on the courthouse steps, putting rounds through that dead Chevy with a Remington pump. Don't let anyone tell you he wasn't there. Norbert Keene is sitting in front of you and telling you he was. By the time the firing stopped, those cars didn't look like cars at all anymore, just hunks of junk with glass around them. Men started to walk over to them. No one talked. All you could hear was the wind and feet gritting over broken glass. That's when the picture-taking started. And you ought to know this, Sonny. When the picture-taking starts, the story is over.
Mr. Keene rocked in his chair, his slippers bumping placidly on the floor, looking at me. There's nothing like that in the Derry News, was all I could think of to say. The headline for that day had read, State Police FBI Gunned Down Bradley Gang in Pitched Battle, with the subhead, Local Police Lend Support.
Course not, Mr. Keene said, laughing delightedly. I seen the publisher, Mac Laughlin, put 2 rounds into Joe Conklin himself.
Christ, I muttered.
Get enough licorice, Sonny?
I got enough, I said. I licked my lips.
Mr. Keene, how could a thing of that magnitude be covered up?
Wasn't no cover-up, he said, looking honestly surprised. It was just that no one talked about it much. And really, who cared? It wasn't President and Mrs. Hoover who went down that day. It was no worse than shooting mad dogs that would kill you with a bite if you give them half a chance.
But the women?
Couple of whores, he said indifferently. Besides, it happened in Derry, not in New York or Chicago. The place makes it news as much as what happened in the place, Sonny. That's why there are bigger headlines when an earthquake kills 12 people in Los Angeles than there are when one kills 3,000 in some heathen country in the Mideast.
Besides, it happened in Derry. I've heard it before, and I suppose if I continue to pursue this, I'll hear it again and again and again. They say it as if speaking patiently to a mental defective. They say it the way they would say, because of gravity, if you ask them how come you stick to the ground when you walk. They say it as if it were a natural law any natural man should understand. And of course, the worst of that is, I do understand. I had one more question for Norbert Keene.
Did you see anyone at all that day that you didn't recognize once the shooting started? Mr. Keene's answer was quick enough to drop my blood temperature 10 degrees, or so it felt.
The clown, you mean? How did you find out about him, Sonny?
Oh, I heard it somewhere, I said.
I only caught a glimpse of him. Once things got hot, I tended pretty much to my own knitting. I glanced around just once and saw him up street beyond them Swedes under the Bijou's marquee,
Mr. Keene said.
He wasn't wearing a clown suit or nothing like that. He was dressed in a pair of farmer's bibs and a cotton shirt underneath. But his face was covered with that white grease paint they used, and he had a big red clown smile painted on. Also had these tufts of fake hair, you know. Orange. Sort of comical. Lal Machen never saw that fellow, but Biff did. Only Biff must have been confused, because he thought he saw him in one of the windows of an apartment over somewhere to the left. And once when I asked Jimmy Gordon, he was killed in Pearl Harbor, you know, went down with his ship, the California, I think it was. He said he saw the guy behind the war memorial.
Mr. Keene shook his head, smiling a little.
It's funny how people get during a thing like that, and even funnier what they remember after it's all over. You can listen to 16 different tales, and no two of them will jibe together. Take the gun that clown fellow had, for instance.
Gun? I asked. He was shooting, too?
Yeah, Mr. Keene said. The one glimpse I caught of him, it looked like he had a Winchester bolt action, and it wasn't until later that I figured out I must have thought that because that's what I had. Biff Marlowe thought he had a Remington, because that was what he had. And when I asked Jimmy about it, he said that guy was shooting an old Springfield just like his. Funny, huh?
Funny, I managed. Mr. Keene, didn't any of you wonder what in hell a clown, especially one in farmer's bibs, was doing there just then?
Sure, Mr. Keene said. It wasn't no big deal, you understand. But sure, we wondered. Most of us figured it was somebody who wanted to attend the party but didn't want to be recognized. A town council member, maybe. Horst Mueller, maybe. Or even Trace Nogler, who was mayor back then. Or it could just have been a professional man who didn't want to be recognized. A doctor or a lawyer. I wouldn't have recognized my own father in a get-up like that.
He laughed a little, and I asked him what was funny.
There's also a possibility that it was a real clown, he said. Back in the 20s and 30s, the county fair in Estee came a lot earlier than it does now, and it was set up and going full blast the week that the Bradley gang met their end. There were clowns at the county fair. Maybe one of them heard we were going to have our own little carnival and rode down because he wanted to be in on it.
He smiled at me dryly.
I'm about talked out, he said, but I'll tell you one more thing, since you appear to be so interested and you listen so close. It was something Biff Marlowe said about 16 years later, when we were having a few beers up to Pilots in Bangor. Right out of a clear blue sky, he said it. Said that clown was leaning out of the window so far that Biff couldn't believe he wasn't falling out. It wasn't just his head and shoulders and arms that was out. Biff said he was right out to the knees, hanging there in midair, shooting down at the cars the Bradleys had come in, with that big red grin on his face. He was tricked out like a jack-o'-lantern that had got a bad scare, was how Biff put it.
Like he was floating, I said.
Yeah, Mr. Keene agreed. And Biff said there was something else, something that bothered him for weeks afterward. One of those things you get right on the tip of your tongue but won't quite come off. Or something that lights on your skin like a mosquito or a no-see-um. He said he finally figured out what it was one night when he had to get up and tap a kidney. He stood there whizzing into the bowl, thinking of nothing in particular, when it come to him all at once that it was 2:25 in the afternoon when the shooting started, and the sun was out, but that clown didn't cast any shadow. No shadow at all.
Part 4, July of 1958. You lethargic, waiting upon me, waiting for the fire, and I attendant upon you, shaken by your beauty, shaken by your beauty, shaken. William Carlos Williams, Patterson. Well, I was born in my birthday suit. The doctor slapped my behind. He said, "You're gonna be special, you sweet little toot-toot." Sidney Simeon, My Toot-Toot. Chapter 13, The Apocalyptic Rock Fight. 1. Bill's there first.
He sits in one of the wingback chairs just inside the reading room door, watching as Mike deals with the library's last few customers of the night. An old lady with a clutch of paperback gothics, a man with a huge historical tome on the Civil War, and a skinny kid waiting to check out a novel with a 7-day rental sticker in an upper corner of its plastic cover. Bill sees, with no sense of surprise or serendipity at all, that it is his own latest novel. He feels that surprise is beyond him, serendipity a believed-in reality that has turned out to be only a dream after all. A pretty girl, her tartan skirt held together with a big gold safety pin. Christ, I haven't seen one of those in years, Bill thinks. Are they coming back? Is feeding quarters into the Xerox machine and copying an off-print with one eye on the big pendulum clock behind the checkout desk. The sounds are library soft and library comforting. The hushed squeak of soles and heels on the red and black linoleum of the floor. The steady tock and tick of the clock dropping off dry seconds. The cat-like purr of the copying machine. The boy takes his William Denbrough novel and goes to the girl at the copier just as she finishes and begins to square up her pages. You can just leave that off-print on the desk, Mary, Mike says. I'll put it away. She flashes a grateful smile. Thanks, Mr. Hanlon. Good night. Good night, Billy. The two of you go right home. The boogeyman will get you if you don't. Watch out. Billy, the skinny kid, chants and slips a proprietary arm around the girl's slim waist. Well, I don't think he'd want a pair as ugly as you two, Mike says, but be careful all the same. We will, Mr. Hanlon, Mary replies, seriously enough, and punches the boy lightly on the shoulder. Come on, ugly, she says, and giggles. When she does this, she is transformed from a pretty, mildly desirable high school junior into the cultish, not quite gawky 11-year-old that Beverly Marsh had been. And as they pass him, Bill is shaken by her beauty, and he feels fear. He wants to go to the boy and tell him earnestly that he must go home by well-lighted streets and not look around if someone speaks. You can't be careful on a skateboard, mister, a phantom voice says inside his head, and Bill smiles a rueful grown-up smile. He watches the boy open the door for his girl. They go into the vestibule, moving closer together, and Bill would have bet the royalties of the book the boy named Billy is holding under his arm that he has stolen a kiss before opening the outer door for the girl. More fool you if you didn't, Billy, my man, he thinks. Now see her home safe. For Christ's sake, see her home safe. Mike calls, Be right with you, Big Bill. Just let me file this. Bill nods and crosses his legs. The paper bag on his lap crackles a little. There's a pint of bourbon inside, and he reckons he has never wanted a drink so badly in his life as he does right now. Mike will be able to supply water, if not ice, and the way he feels right now, a very little water will be enough. He thinks of Silver leaning against the wall of Mike's garage on Palmer Lane. And from that, his thoughts progress naturally to the day they had met in the Barrens, all except Mike. And each had told his tale again. Lepers under porches, mummies who walked on the ice, blood from drains and dead boys in the standpipe, and pictures that moved and werewolves that chased small boys down deserted streets. They had gone deeper into the Barrens that day before the 4th of July, he remembers now. It had been hot in town, but cool in the tangled shade of the eastern bank of the Kanduskeag. He remembers one of those concrete cylinders not far away, humming to itself, the way the Xerox machine had hummed for the pretty high school girl just now. Bill remembers that, and how, when all the stories were done, the others had looked at him. They had wanted him to tell them what they should do next, how they should proceed, and he simply didn't know. The not knowing had filled him with a kind of desperation. Looking at Mike's shadow now, looming large on the darkly paneled wall in the reference room, a sudden sureness comes to him. He hadn't known then because they hadn't been complete when they met that July 3rd afternoon. The completion had come later, at the abandoned gravel pit beyond the dump, where you could climb out of the Barrens easily on either side, Kansas Street or Merritt Street. Right around, in fact, where the interstate overpass was now. The gravel pit had no name. It was old, its crumbly sides crabby with weeds and bushes. There had still been plenty of ammunition there, more than enough for an apocalyptic rock fight. But before that, on the bank of the Kanduskeag, he hadn't been sure what to say. What did they want him to say? What did he want to say? He remembers looking from one face to the next. Ben's, Bev's, Eddie's, Stan's, Richie's. And he remembers music. Little Richard. Lomp, bomp, a lomp, bomp. Music. Low. And darts of light in his eyes. He remembers the darts of light because... 2. Richie had hung his transistor radio over the lowermost branch of the tree he was leaning against. Although they were in the shade, the sun bounced off the surface of the Kenduskeeg onto the radio's chrome facing and from there into Bill's eyes.
To take that thing down, River Richie,
Bill said,
it's gonna blind me.
Sure, Big Bill, Richie said at once, with no smart mouth at all, and removed the radio from the branch. He also turned it off, and Bill wished he hadn't done that. It made the silence, broken only by the rippling water and the vague hum of the sewage pumping machinery, seem very loud. Their eyes watched him, and he wanted to tell them to look somewhere else. What did they think he was, a freak? But of course he couldn't do that, because all they were doing was waiting for him to tell them what to do now. They had come by dreadful knowledge, and they needed him to tell them what to do with it. Why me? He wanted to shout at them. But of course he knew that, too. It was because, like it or not, he had been tapped for the position. Because he was the idea man, because he had lost a brother to whatever it was, but most of all because he had become, in some obscure way he would never completely understand, Big Bill. He glanced at Beverly and looked away quickly from the calm trust in her eyes. Looking at Beverly made him feel funny in the pit of his stomach, fluttery.
We can't go to the police, he said at last.
His voice sounded harsh to his own ears, too loud.
We can't go to our parents, either, unless...
He looked hopefully at Richie.
What about your mom and dad, Four Eyes? They seem pretty regular. My good man, Richie said in his Toodles the Butler voice, you obviously have no understanding whatsoever of my mater and pater. They...
Talk American, Richie. Eddie said from his spot by Ben. He was sitting by Ben for the simple reason that Ben provided enough shade for Eddie to sit in. His face looked small and pinched and worried, an old man's face. His aspirator was in his right hand.
They'd think I was ready for Juniper Hill, Richie said.
He was wearing an old pair of glasses today. The day before, a friend of Henry Bauer's named Guard Jägermeier had come up behind Richie as Richie left the dairy ice cream bar with a pistachio cone.
Tag, you're it!
This Jägermeier, who outweighed Richie by 40 pounds or so, screamed and slammed Richie full in the back with both hands laced together. Richie flew into the gutter, losing his glasses and his ice cream cone. The left lens of his glasses had shattered, and his mother was furious with him about it, lending very little credence to Richie's explanations. All I know is that it was a lot of fooling around, she had said.
Honestly, Richie, do you think there's a glasses tree somewhere and we can just pull off a new pair of spectacles for you whenever you break the old pair? But, Mom, this kid pushed me. He came up behind me, this big kid, and pushed me.
Richie was by then near tears. This failure to make his mother understand hurt much worse than being slammed into the gutter by Guard Jägermeier, who was so stupid they hadn't even bothered to send him to summer school.
I don't want to hear any more about it, Maggie Tozier said flatly. But the next time you see your father come in looking whipped after working late 3 nights in a row, you think a little bit, Richie. You think about it. But, Mom!
No more, I said. Her voice was curt and final. Worse, it was near tears. She left the room then, and the TV went on much too loud. Richie had been left alone, sitting miserably at the kitchen table. It was this memory that caused Richie to shake his head again.
My folks are okay, but they'd never believe something like this. Well, what about other kids?
And they looked around, Bill would remember years later, as if for someone who wasn't there.
Who?
Stan asked doubtfully.
I can't think of anyone else I trust. Just the same,
Bill said in a troubled voice, and a little silence fell among them while Bill thought about what to say next. 3. If asked, Ben Hanscom would have told you that Henry Bowers hated him more than any of the others in the Losers Club because of what had happened that day when he and Henry had shot the chutes down into the Barrens from Kansas Street, because of what had happened the day he and Richie and Beverly escaped from the Aladdin, but most of all because, by not allowing Henry to copy during examinations, he had caused Henry to be sent to summer school and incur the wrath of his father,
the reputedly insane Butch Bowers. If asked, Richie Tozier would have told you Henry hated him more than any of the others because of the day he had fooled Henry and his two other musketeers in Freese's. Stan Uris would have told you that Henry hated him most of all because he was a Jew. When Stan had been in the third grade and Henry the fifth, Henry had once washed Stan's face with snow until it bled and he was screaming hysterically with pain and fear. Bill Dendro believed that Henry hated him the most because he was skinny, because he stuttered, and because he liked to dress well.
Well, look at the fucking pansy,
Henry had cried when the dairy school had had careers day in April and Bill had come wearing a tie. Before the day was over, the tie had been ripped off and flung into a tree halfway down Charter Street. He did hate all four of them, but the boy in Derry, who was number one on Henry's personal hate parade, was not in the Losers Club at all on that July 3rd. He was a black boy named Michael Hanlon, who lived a quarter of a mile down the road from Shirttail Bowers' farm. Henry's father, who was every bit as crazy as he was reputed to be, was Oscar Butch Bowers. Butch Bowers associated his financial, physical, and mental decline with the Hanlon family in general, and with Mike's father in particular. Will Hanlon, he was fond of telling his few friends and his son, had had him thrown in the county jail when all of his, Hanlon's, chickens died. So's he could get the insurance money, don't you know, Butch would say, eyeing his audience with all the baleful interrupt-if-you-dare pugnacity of Captain Billy Bones in the Admiral Benbow. He got some of his friends to lie him up, and that's why I had to sell my mercury. Who lied him up, Daddy? Henry had asked when he was eight, burning at the injustice that had been done to his father. He thought to himself that when he was a grown-up, he would find liar-uppers and coat them with honey and stake them out over anthills, like in some of those Western movies they showed at the Bijou Theater on Saturday afternoons. And because his son was a tireless listener, although if asked, Butch would have maintained that was only as it should be, Bowers Sr. filled his son's ears with a litany of hate and hard luck. He explained to his son that while all niggers were stupid, some were cunning as well, and down deep they all hated white men and wanted to plow a white woman's furrow. Maybe it wasn't just the insurance money after all, Butch said. Maybe Hanlon had decided to lay the blame for the dead chickens at his door because Butch had the next produce stand down the road. He'd done it anyway, and that was just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket. He'd done it and then got a bunch of white nigger bleeding hearts from town to lie him up and threaten Butch with state prison if he didn't pay that nigger off. And why not? Butch would ask his round-eyed, dirty-necked, silent son. Why not? I was just a man who fought the Japs for his country. There was lots of guys like us, but he was the only nigger in the county. The chicken business had been followed by one unlucky incident after another. His dear tractor had blown a rod. His good harrow got busted in the north field. He got a boil on his neck which became infected, had to be lanced, then became infected again and had to be removed surgically. The nigger started using his foully gotten money to undercut Butch's prices, so they lost custom. In Henry's ears, it was a constant litany. The nigger, the nigger, the nigger. Everything was the nigger's fault. The nigger had a nice white house with an upstairs and an oil furnace, while Butch and his wife and his son lived in what was not much better than a tar paper shack. When Butch couldn't make enough money farming and had to go to work in the woods for a while, it was the nigger's fault. When their well went dry in 1956, it was the nigger's fault. Later that same year, Henry, who was then 10 years old, started to feed Mike's dog, Mr. Chips, old stew bones and bags of potato chips. It got so Mr. Chips would wag his tail and come running when Henry called. When the dog was well used to Henry and Henry's treats, Henry one day fed him a pound of hamburger laced with insect poison. The bug killer he found in the back shed. He had saved 3 weeks to buy the meat at Costello's. Mr. Chips ate half the poisoned meat and then stopped. "Go on, finish your treat, nigger dog," Henry had said. Mr. Chips wagged his tail. Since Henry had called him this from the beginning, he believed it was his other name. When the pain started, Henry produced a piece of clothesline and tied Mr. Chips to a birch so he couldn't get away and run home. He then sat on a flat, sun-warmed rock, put his chin in his palms, and watched the dog die. It took a good long time, but Henry considered it time well spent. At the end, Mr. Chips began to convulse, and a thin green foam ran from between his jaws.